Atlantic in a solar-powered submarine. Failed, but a good try. All sorts of things. They'd better not go digging up that Pentagon stuff again, or he'd get his lawyer onto them. He made a mental note to call him in the mor... No. Anyway, can a dead person sue for libel? Only his lawyer would know, and he was not going to be able to call him in the morning. He knew, with a sense of creeping dread, that of all the things he had left behind in the land of the living, it was the telephone he was going to miss the most. And then he turned his mind determinedly back to where it didn't want to go. The figure. It seemed to him that the figure had been almost like a figure of death itself. Or was that his imagination playing tricks with him? Was he dreaming that it was a cowled figure? What would any figure, whether cowled or just casually dressed, be doing in the boot of his car? At that moment, a car zipped past him on the road and disappeared off into the night, taking its oasis of light with it. He thought with longing of the warm, leather-upholstered, climate-controlled comfort of his own car, abandoned on the road behind him. And then a sudden, extraordinary thought struck him. Was there any way he could hitch a lift? Could anyone actually see him? How would anyone react if they could? Well, there was only one way to find out. He heard another car coming up in the distance behind him, and turned to face it. The twin pools of hazy lights approached through the mist, and Gordon gritted his phantom teeth and stuck his thumb out at them. The car swept by regardless. Nothing. Angrily, he made an indistinct V-sign at the receding red rear lights, and realized, looking straight through his own upraised arm, that he wasn't at his most visible at the moment. Was there perhaps some effort of will he could make to render himself more visible when he wanted to? He screwed up his eyes in concentration, then realized he would need to have his eyes open in order to judge the results. He tried again, forcing his mind as hard as he could, but the results were unsatisfactory. Though it did seem to make some kind of rudimentary glowing difference, he couldn't sustain it, and it faded almost immediately, however much he piled on the mental pressure. He would have to judge the timing very carefully if he was going to make his presence felt, or at least seen. Another car approached, from behind, travelling fast. He turned again, stuck his thumb out, waited till the moment was right, and willed himself visible. The car swerved slightly, then carried on its way, only a little more slowly. Well, that was something. What else could he do? He would go and stand under a lamppost for a start, and he would practice. The next car he would get for sure. Chapter 12. So, if you'd like to leave a message, I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Maybe. Beep. Shit, damn, hold on a minute, blast, look up, click. Richard pushed the phone back into its cradle and slammed his car into reverse for 20 yards to have another look at the signpost by the road junction he just sped past in the mist. He had extracted himself from the Cambridge one-way system by the usual method, which involved going round and round it faster and faster until he achieved a sort of escape velocity and flew off at a tangent in a random direction, which he was now trying to identify and correct for. Arriving back at the junction, he tried to correlate the information on the signpost with the information on the map, but it couldn't be done. The road junction was quite deliberately sitting on a page divide on the map, and the signpost was revolving maliciously in the wind. Instinct told him that he was heading in the wrong direction, but he didn't want to go back the way he'd come for fear of getting sucked back into the gravitational whirlpool of Cambridge's traffic system. He turned left, therefore, in the hope of finding better fortune in that direction, but after a while lost his nerve and turned a speculative right, and then chanced another exploratory left, and after a few more such manoeuvres was thoroughly lost. He swore to himself and turned up the heating in the car. If he had been concentrating on where he was going, rather than trying to navigate and telephone at the same time, he told himself, he would at least know where he was now. He didn't actually like having a telephone in his car. He found it a bother and an intrusion, but Gordon had insisted, and indeed had paid for it. He sighed in exasperation, backed up the black Saab, and turned around again. As he did so, he nearly ran into someone lugging a body into a field. At least, that was what it looked like for a second to his overwrought brain, but in fact it was probably a local farmer with a sack full of something nutritious. Though what he was doing with it on a night like this was anyone's guess. As his headlights swung round again, they caught for a moment a silhouette of the figure trudging off across the field with the sack on his back. Rather him than me, thought Richard grimly, and drove off again. After a few minutes, he reached a junction with what looked a little more like a main road. Nearly turned right down it, but then turned left and said, there was no signpost. He poked at the buttons on his phone again. Get back to you as soon as possible. Maybe. Beep. Susan, it's Richard. Where do I start? What a mess. Look, I'm sorry, sorry, sorry. I screwed up very badly, and it's all my fault. And look, whatever it takes to make up for it, I'll do it. Solemn promise. He had a slight feeling that this wasn't the right tone to adopt with an answering machine, but he carried straight on. Honestly, we can go away, we take a holiday for a week, or even just this weekend if you like. Really, this weekend, we'll go somewhere sunny. Doesn't matter how much pressure Gordon tries to put on me, and you know the sort of pressure he can muster. He is your brother, after all. I'll just, actually, it might have to be next weekend. Damn, damn, damn. It's just that I really have promised to get... No, look, it doesn't matter. We'll just do it. I don't care about getting Anthem finished for Comdex. It's not the end of the world. We'll just go. Gordon will just have to take a running jump. Gah! Richard swerved wildly to avoid the spectre of Gordon Way, which suddenly loomed in his headlights and took a running jump at him. He slammed on the brakes, started to skid, tried to remember what it was you were supposed to do when you found yourself skidding. He knew he'd seen it on some television program about driving. He'd seen ages ago. What was the program? God, he couldn't even remember the title of the program. Let alone, oh yes, they said you mustn't slam on the brakes. That was it. The world swung sickeningly round him with slow and appalling force as the car slewed across the road, spun, thudded against the grass verge, then slithered and rocked itself to a halt, facing the wrong way. He collapsed, panting, against the steering wheel. He picked up the phone from where he'd dropped it. "Susan," he gasped, "I'll get back to you," and hung up. He raised his eyes. Standing full in the glare of his headlights was the spectral figure of Gordon Way, staring straight in through the windscreen with ghastly horror in its eyes, slowly raising its hand and pointing at him. He wasn't sure how long he just sat there. The apparition had melted from view in a few seconds, but Richard simply sat, shaking, probably for not more than a minute, until a sudden squeal of brakes and glare of lights roused him. He shook his head. He was, he realized, stopped in the road, facing the wrong way. The car that had just screeched to an abrupt halt, almost bumper to bumper with him, was a police car. He took two or three deep breaths, and then, stiff and trembling, he climbed out and stood up to face the officer who was walking slowly towards him, silhouetted in the police car's headlights. The officer looked him up and down. "I'm sorry, officer," said Richard, with as much calmness as he could wrench into his voice. I skidded. The roads are slippery, and I skidded. I spun round, as you see. I'm facing the wrong way." He gestured at his car to indicate the way it was facing. "Like to tell me why it was you skidded then, exactly, sir?" The police officer was looking him straight in the eye while pulling out a notebook. "Well, as I said," explained Richard, "the roads are slippery because of the mist, and, well, to be perfectly honest..." He suddenly found himself saying, in spite of all his attempts to stop himself, "I was just driving along, and I suddenly imagined that I saw my employer throwing himself in front of my car." The officer gazed at him levelly. "Guilt complex, officer," added Richard with a twitch of a smile. "You know how it is. I was contemplating taking the weekend off." The police officer seemed to hesitate, balanced on a knife edge between sympathy and suspicion. His eyes narrowed a little, but didn't waver. "Been drinking, sir?" "Yes," said Richard with a quick sigh, but very little. Two glasses of wine, max, and a small glass of port. Absolute max. It was really just a lapse of concentration. I'm fine now." "Name?" Richard gave him his name and address. The policeman wrote it all down carefully and neatly in his book, then peered at the car registration number and wrote that down too. "And who is your employer then, sir?" "His name's Way, Gordon Way." "Oh," said the policeman, raising his eyebrows. "The computer gentleman." Yes, that's right. I designed software for the company, WayForward Technologies, too." "We've got one of your computers down the station," said the policeman. "Bug it if I can get it to work." "Oh," said Richard wearily, "which model do you have?" "I think it's called a Quark 2. "Oh, well, that's simple," said Richard with relief. "It doesn't work. Never has. The thing is a heap of shit." "Funny thing, sir. That's what I've always said," said the policeman. "Some of the other lads don't agree." "Oh, well, you're absolutely right, officer. The thing is hopeless. It's the major reason the original company went bust. I suggest you use it as a big paperweight." "Well, I wouldn't like to do that, sir," the policeman persisted. "The door would keep blowing open." "What do you mean, officer?" asked Richard. "I use it to keep the door closed, sir. Nasty drafts down our station this time of year. In the summer, of course, we beat suspects around the head with it." He flipped his book closed and prodded it into his pocket. "My advice to you, sir, is to go nice and easy on the way back. Lock up the car and spend the weekend getting completely pissed. I find it's the only way. Mind how you go now." He returned to his car, wound down the window, and watched Richard manoeuvre his car around and drive off into the night before heading off himself. Richard took a deep breath, drove calmly back to London, let himself calmly into his flat, clambered calmly over the sofa, sat down, poured himself a stiff brandy, and began seriously to shake. There were three things he was shaking about. There was the simple physical shock of his near accident, which is the sort of thing that always churns you up a lot more than you expect. The body floods itself with adrenaline, which then hangs around your system, turning sour. Then there was the cause of the skid, the extraordinary apparition of Gordon throwing himself in front of his car at that moment. Boy, oh boy. Richard took a mouthful of brandy and gargled with it. He put the glass down. It was well known that Gordon was one of the world's richest natural resources of guilt pressure, and that he could deliver a ton on your doorstep fresh every morning, but Richard hadn't realized he had let it get to him to such an unholy degree. He took up his glass again, went upstairs, and pushed open the door to his workroom, which involved shifting a stack of Bite magazines that had toppled against it. He pushed them away with his foot and walked to the end of the large room. A lot of glass at this end let in views over a large part of North London, from which the mist was now clearing. St. Paul's glowed in the dark distance, and he stared at it for a moment or two, but it didn't do anything special. After the events of the evening, he found this came as a pleasant surprise. At the other end of the room were a couple of long tables, smothered in, at the last count, 6 Macintosh computers. In the middle was the Mac 2, on which a red wireframe model of his sofa was lazily revolving within a blue wireframe model of his narrow staircase, complete with banister rail, radiator, and fuse box details, and, of course, the awkward turn halfway up. The sofa would start out spinning in one direction, hit an obstruction, twist itself into another plane, hit another obstruction, revolve around a third axis until it was stopped again, then cycle through the moves again in a different order. You didn't have to watch the sequence for very long before you saw it repeat itself. The sofa was clearly stuck. 3 other Macs were connected up via long tangles of cable to an untidy agglomeration of synthesizers. An emulated 2+ HD sampler, a rack of TX modules, a Prophet VS, a Roland JX-10, a Korg DW-8000, an Octopad, a left-handed Syntax MIDI guitar controller, and even an old drum machine stacked up and gathering dust in the corner. Pretty much the works. There was also a small and rarely used cassette tape recorder. All the music was stored in sequencer files on the computers, rather than on tape. He dumped himself into a seat in front of one of the Macs to see what, if anything, it was doing. It was displaying an untitled Excel spreadsheet, and he wondered why. He saved it and looked to see if he'd left himself any notes, and quickly discovered that the spreadsheet contained some of the data he'd previously downloaded after searching the World Reporter and Knowledge Online databases for facts about swallows. He now had figures which detailed their migratory habits, their wing shapes, their aerodynamic profile and turbulence characteristics, and some sort of rudimentary figures concerning the patterns that a flock would adopt in flight, but as yet he had only the faintest idea as to how he was going to synthesize them all together. Because he was too tired to think particularly constructively tonight, he savagely selected and copied a whole swathe of figures from the spreadsheet at random, pasted them into his own conversion program, which scaled and filtered and manipulated the figures according to his own experimental algorithms, loaded the converted file into Performer, a powerful sequencer program, and played the result through random MIDI channels to whichever synthesizers happened to be on at the moment. The result was a short burst of the most hideous cacophony, and he stopped it. He ran the conversion program again, this time instructing it to force map the pitch values into G minor. This was a utility he was determined in the end to get rid of, because he regarded it as cheating. If there was any basis to his firmly held belief that the rhythms and harmonies of music which he found most satisfying could be found in, or at least derived from, the rhythms and harmonies of naturally occurring phenomena, then satisfying forms of modality and intonation should emerge naturally as well, rather than being forced. For the moment, though, he forced it. The result was a short burst of the most hideous cacophony in G minor. So much for random shortcuts. The first task was a relatively simple one, which should be simply to plot the waveform described by the tip of a swallow's wing as it flies, then synthesize that waveform. That way he would end up with a single note, which would be a good start and shouldn't take more than the weekend to do. Except, of course, that he didn't have a weekend available to do it in, because he had somehow to get version 2 of Anthem out of the door sometime during the course of the next year, or month, as Gordon called it. Which brought Richard inexorably to the third thing he was shaking about. There was absolutely no way that he could take the time off this weekend or next to fulfil the promise he had made to Susan's telephone answering machine. And that, if this evening's debacle had not already done so, would surely spell the final end. But that was it. The thing was done. There is nothing you can do about a message on someone else's answering machine other than let events take their course. It was done. It was irrevocable. An odd thought suddenly struck him. It took him by considerable surprise, but he couldn't really see what was wrong with it. Chapter 13. A pair of binoculars scanning the London night skyline. Idly, curious, snooping. A little look here, a little look there, just seeing what's going on. Anything interesting, anything useful. The binoculars settle on the back of one particular house, attracted by a slight movement. One of those large, late Victorian villas, probably flats now. Lots of black iron drain pipes, green rubber dustbins, but dark. Nope, nothing. The binoculars are just moving onwards when another slight movement catches in the moonlight. The binoculars refocus very slightly, trying to find a detail, a hard edge, a slight contrast in the darkness. The mist has lifted now, and the darkness glistens. They refocus a very, very little more. There it is, something, definitely, only this time a little higher up, maybe a foot or so, maybe a yard. The binoculars settle and relax, steady, trying for the edge, trying for the detail. There. The binoculars settle again. They have found their mark, straddled between a windowsill and a drainpipe. It is a dark figure, splayed against the wall, looking down, looking for a new foothold, looking upwards, looking for a ledge. The binoculars peer intently. The figure is that of a tall, thin man. His clothes are right for the job, dark trousers, dark sweater, but his movements are awkward and angular. Nervous. Interesting. The binoculars wait and consider, consider and judge. The man is clearly a rank amateur. Look at his fumbling, look at his ineptitude. His feet slip on the drainpipe, his hands can't reach the ledge. He nearly falls, he waits to catch his breath. For a moment, he starts to climb back down again, but seems to find that even tougher going. He lunges again for the ledge, and this time catches it. His foot shoots out to steady himself and nearly misses the pipe. Could have been very nasty indeed. But now the way is easier and progress is better. He crosses to another pipe, reaches a third-floor window ledge, flirts briefly with death as he crawls painfully onto it, and makes the cardinal error and looks down. He sways briefly and sits back heavily. He shades his eyes and peers inside to check that the room is dark, and sets about getting the window open. One of the things that distinguish the amateur from the professional is that this is the point when the amateur thinks it would have been a good idea to bring along something to prise the window open with. Luckily for this amateur, the householder is an amateur too, and the sash window slides grudgingly up. The climber crawls with some relief inside. He should be locked up for his own protection, think the binoculars. A hand starts to reach for the phone. At the window, a face looks back out and for a moment is caught in the moonlight. And then it ducks back inside to carry on with its business. The hand stays hovering over the phone for a moment or two, while the binoculars wait and consider, consider and judge. The hand reaches instead for the A to Z street map of London. There is a long, studious pause, a little more intent binocular work, and then the hand reaches for the phone again, lifts it, and dials. Chapter 14. Susan's flat was small but spacious, which was a trick, reflected Richard tensely as he turned on the light, that only women seem able to pull off. It wasn't that observation which made him tense, of course. He'd thought it before, many times. Every time he'd been in her flat, in fact. It always struck him, usually because he had just come from his own flat, which was four times the size and cramped. He had just come from his own flat this time, only via a rather eccentric route, and it was this that made his usual observation unusually tense. Despite the chill of the night, he was sweating. He looked back out of the window, turned and tiptoed across the room, where the telephone and the answering machine stood on their own small table. There was no point, he told himself, in tiptoeing. Susan wasn't in. He would be extremely interested in knowing where she was, in fact, just as she, he told himself, had probably been extremely interested in knowing where he had been at the beginning of the evening. He realized he was still tiptoeing. He hit his leg to make himself stop doing it, but carried on doing it nonetheless. Climbing up the outside wall had been terrifying. He wiped his forehead with the arm of his oldest and greasiest sweater. There had been a nasty moment when his life had flashed before his eyes, but he'd been too preoccupied with falling and had missed all the good bits. Most of the good bits had involved Susan, he realized. Susan or computers. Never Susan and computers. Those had largely been the bad bits. Which was why he was here, he told himself. He seemed to need convincing, and told himself again. He looked at his watch. 11:45. It occurred to him he'd better go and wash his wet and dirty hands before he touched anything. It wasn't the police he was worried about, but Susan's terrifying cleaner. She would know. He went into the bathroom, turned on the light switch, wiped it, and then stared at his own startled face in the bright neon-lit mirror as he ran the water over his hands. For a moment he thought of the dancing warm candlelight of the Coleridge dinner, and the images of it welled up out of the dim and distant past of the earlier part of the evening. Life had seemed easy then, and carefree, the wine, the conversation, simple conjuring tricks. He pictured the round, pale face of Sarah, pop-eyed with wonder. He washed his own face. He thought, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. He brushed his own hair. He thought, too, of the pictures hanging high in the darkness over their heads. He cleaned his teeth. The low buzz of the neon light snapped him back to the present, and he suddenly remembered with appalled shock that he was here in his capacity as burglar. Something made him look himself directly in the face in the mirror. Then he shook his head, trying to clear it. When would Susan be back? That, of course, would depend on what she was doing. He quickly wiped his hands and made his way back to the answering machine. He prodded at the buttons, and his conscience prodded back at him. The tape wound back for what seemed to be an interminable time, and he realized with a jolt that it was probably because Gordon had been in full flood. He had forgotten, of course, that there would be messages on the tape other than his own, and listening to other people's phone messages was tantamount to opening their mail. He explained to himself once again that all he was trying to do was to undo a mistake he had made before it caused any irrevocable damage. He would just play tinier snippets until he found his own voice. That wouldn't be too bad. He wouldn't even be able to distinguish what was being said. He groaned inwardly, gritted his teeth, and stabbed at the play button so roughly that he missed it and ejected the cassette by mistake. He put it back in and pushed the play button more carefully. Beep! Oh, Susan, hi, it's Gordon, said the answering machine. Just on my way to the cottage, it's a... He wound forward for a couple of seconds. Need to know that Richard is on the case. I mean, really on... Richard set his mouth grimly and stabbed at the fast-forward button again. He really hated the fact that Gordon tried to put pressure on him via Susan, which Gordon always stoutly denied he did. Richard couldn't blame Susan for getting exasperated about his work sometimes if this sort of thing was going on. Pick. Response. Make a note to Susan, would you please, to get an armed response sign made up with a sharp spike on the bottom at the right height for rabbits to see. What? Muttered Richard to himself, and his finger hesitated for a second over the fast-forward button. He had a feeling that Gordon desperately wanted to be like Howard Hughes, and if he could never hope to be remotely as rich, he could at least try to be twice as eccentric, an act, a palpable act. That's Secretary Susan at the office, not you, of course, continued Gordon's voice on the answering machine. Where was I? Oh, yes, Richard and Anthem too. Susan, that thing has got to be in beta testing in two... Richard stabbed at the fast-forward, tight-lipped. Point is that there's only one person who's really in a position to know if he's getting the important work done, or if he's just dreaming, and that one person... He stabbed angrily again. He had promised himself he wouldn't listen to any of it, and now here he was getting angry at what he was hearing. He should really just stop this. Well, just one more try. When he listened again, he just got music. Odd. He wound forward again and still got music. Why would someone be phoning to play music to an answering machine, he wondered. The phone rang. He stopped the tape and answered it, then almost dropped the phone like an electric eel as he realized what he was doing. Hardly daring to breathe, he held the telephone to his ear. Rule one in housebreaking, said a voice. Never answer the phone when you're in the middle of a job. Who are you supposed to be, for heaven's sake? Richard froze. It was a moment or two before he could find where he had put his voice. Who is this? He demanded at last in a whisper. Rule two, continued the voice. Preparation. Bring the right tools. Bring gloves. Try to have the faintest glimmering of an idea of what you're about before you start dangling from window ledges in the middle of the night. Rule three. Never forget rule two. Who is this? Exclaimed Richard again. The voice was unperturbed. Neighbourhood watch, it said. If you just look out of the back window, you'll see. Trailing the phone, Richard hurried over to the window and looked out. A distant flash startled him. Rule four. Never stand where you can be photographed. Rule five. Are you listening to me, Macduff? What? Yes, said Richard in bewilderment. How do you know me? Rule five. Never admit to your name. Richard stood silent, breathing hard. I run a little course, said the voice, if you're interested. Richard said nothing. You're learning, continued the voice. Slowly, but you're learning. If you were learning fast, you would have put the phone down by now, of course, but you're curious and incompetent, and so you don't. I don't run a course for novice burglars, as it happens. Tempting, though the idea is, I'm sure there would be grants available. If we have to have them, they may as well be trained. However, if I did run such a course, I would allow you to enrol for free, because I too am curious. Curious to know why Mr. Richard Macduff, who I am given to understand is now a wealthy young man, something in the computer industry, I believe, should suddenly be needing to resort to housebreaking. Who? So, I do a little research, phone directory inquiries, and discover that the flat into which he is breaking is that of a Miss S. Way. I know that Mr. Richard Macduff's employer is the famous Mr. G. Way, and I wonder if they can, by any chance, be related. Who? You are speaking with Sflad, commonly known as Dirk Chaley, currently trading under the name of Gently, for reasons which it would be otiose at this moment to rehearse. I bid you good evening. If you wish to know more, I will be at the Pizza Express in Upper Street in 10 minutes. Bring some money. Dirk! Exclaimed Richard. You? Are you trying to blackmail me? No, you fool, for the pizzas. There was a click, and Dirk Gently rang off. Richard stood transfixed for a moment or two, wiped his forehead again, and gently replaced the phone, as if it were an injured hamster. His brain began to buzz gently and suck its thumb. Lots of little synapses deep in his cerebral cortex all joined hands and started dancing around and singing nursery rhymes. He shook his head to try and make them stop, and quickly sat down at the answering machine again. He fought with himself over whether or not he was going to push the play button again, and then did so anyway before he had made up his mind. Hardly 4 seconds of light orchestral music had oozed soothingly past when there came the sound of a key scratching in the lock out in the hallway. In panic, Richard thumped the eject button, popped the cassette out, rammed it into his jeans pocket, and replaced it from the pile of fresh cassettes that lay next to the machine. There was a similar pile next to his own machine at home. Susan at the office provided them. Poor, long-suffering Susan at the office. He must remember to feel sympathy for her in the morning, when he had the time and concentration for it. Suddenly, without even noticing himself doing it, he changed his mind. In a flash, he popped the substitute cassette out of the machine again, replaced the one he had stolen, rammed down the rewind button, and made a lunge for the sofa, where, with 2 seconds to go before the door opened, he tried to arrange himself into a nonchalant and winning posture. On an impulse, he stuck his left hand up behind his back, where it might come in useful. He was just trying to arrange his features into an expression composed in equal parts of contrition, cheerfulness, and sexual allurement, when the door opened and in walked Michael Wenton Weeks. Everything stopped. Outside, the wind ceased. Owls halted in mid-flight. Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Certainly the central heating chose that moment to shut down, unable perhaps to cope with the supernatural chill that suddenly seemed to whip through the room. "What are you doing here, Wednesday?" demanded Richard. He rose from the sofa as if levitated with anger. Michael Wenton Weeks was a large, sad-faced man, known by some people as Michael Wednesday Week, because that was when he usually promised to have things done by. He was dressed in a suit that had been superbly well-tailored when his father, the late Lord Magna, had bought it 40 years previously. Michael Wenton Weeks came very high on the small but select list of people whom Richard thoroughly disliked. He disliked him because he found the idea of someone who was not only privileged, but was also sorry for himself because he thought the world didn't really understand the problems of privileged people, deeply obnoxious. Michael, on the other hand, disliked Richard for the fairly simple reason that Richard disliked him and made no secret of it. Michael gave a slow and lugubrious look back out into the hallway as Susan walked through. She stopped when she saw Richard. She put down her handbag, unwound her scarf, unbuttoned her coat, slipped it off, handed it to Michael, walked over to Richard, and smacked him in the face. "I've been saving that up all evening," she said furiously, "and don't pretend that's a bunch of flowers you've forgotten to bring which you're hiding behind your back. You tried that gag last time." She turned and stalked off. "It's a box of chocolates I forgot this time," said Richard glumly, and held out his empty hand to her retreating back. "I climbed up the entire outside wall without them. Did I feel a fool when I got in?" "Not very funny," said Susan. She swept into the kitchen and sounded as if she was grinding coffee with her bare hands. For someone who always looked so neat and sweet and delicate, she packed a hell of a temper. "It's true," said Richard, ignoring Michael completely. "I nearly killed myself." "I'm not going to rise to that," said Susan from within the kitchen. "If you want something big and sharp thrown at you, why don't you come in here and be funny?" "I suppose it'll be pointless saying I'm sorry at this point," Richard called out. "You bet," said Susan. sweeping back out of the kitchen again. She looked at him with her eyes flashing and actually stamped her foot. "Honestly, Richard," she said, "I suppose you're going to say you forgot again. How can you have the gall to stand there with two arms, two legs and a head as if you're a human being? This is behaviour that a bout of amoebic dysentery would be ashamed of. I bet that even the very lowest form of dysentery amoeba shows up to take its girlfriend out for a quick trot around the stomach lining once in a while. Well, I hope you had a lousy evening." "I did," said Richard. "You wouldn't have liked it. There was a horse in the bathroom, and you know how you hate that sort of thing." "Oh, Michael," said Susan brusquely, "don't just stand there like a sinking pudding. Thank you very much for dinner and the concert. You were very sweet, and I did enjoy listening to your troubles all evening because they were such a nice change from mine. But I think it'd be best if I just found your book and pushed you out. I've got some serious jumping up and down and ranting to do, and I know how it upsets your delicate sensibilities." She retrieved her coat from him and hung it up. While he'd been holding it, he had seemed entirely taken up with this task and oblivious to anything else. Without it, he seemed a little lost and naked, and was forced to stir himself back into life. He turned his big, heavy eyes back on Richard. "Richard," he said, "I read your piece in Fathom on music and fractal landscape," said Richard shortly. He didn't want to talk to Michael, and he certainly didn't want to get drawn into a conversation about Michael's wretched magazine, or rather, the magazine that used to be Michael's. That was the precise aspect of the conversation that Richard didn't want to get drawn into. Yes, very interesting, of course," said Michael in his silky, over-rounded voice. "Mountain shapes and tree shapes and all sorts of things. Recycled algae. Recursive algorithms. Yes, of course, very interesting, but so wrong, so terribly wrong. For the magazine, I mean. It is, after all, an arts review. I would never have allowed such a thing, of course. Ross has utterly ruined it. Utterly. He'll have to go. Have to. He has no sensibilities and is a thief." "He's not a thief, Wednesday. That's absolutely absurd," snapped Richard, instantly getting drawn into it in spite of his resolution not to. "He had nothing to do with your getting the push whatsoever. That was your own silly fault, and you—" There was a sharp intake of breath. "Richard," said Michael in his softest, quietest voice, arguing with him was like getting tangled in parachute silk, "I think you do not understand how important—" "Michael," said Susan, gently but firmly, holding open the door. Michael Wenton Weeks nodded faintly, and seemed to deflate. "Your book," Susan added, holding out to him a small and elderly volume on the ecclesiastical architecture of Kent. He took it, murmured some slight thanks, looked about him for a moment as if he'd suddenly realized something rather odd, then gathered himself together, nodded farewell, and left. Richard didn't appreciate quite how tense he had become till Michael left and he was suddenly able to relax. He'd always resented the indulgent soft spot that Susan had for Michael, even if she did try to disguise it by being terribly rude to him all the time, perhaps even because of that. "Susan, what can I say?" he started lamely. "You could say ouch for a start. You didn't even give me that satisfaction when I hit you, and I thought I did it rather hard. God, it's freezing in here. What's that window doing wide open?" She went over to shut it. "I told you, that's how I got in," said Richard. He sounded sufficiently as if he meant it to make her look around at him in surprise. "Really," he said, "like in the chocolate ads, only I forgot the box of chocolates." He shrugged sheepishly. She stared at him in amazement. "What on earth possessed you to do that?" she said. She stuck her head out of the window and looked down. "You could have got killed," she said, turning back to him. Well, yes, he said. "It just seemed the only way to, I don't know." He ran at himself. "You took your key back, remember?" "Yes, I got fed up with you coming and raiding my larder when you couldn't be bothered to do your own shopping. Richard, you really climbed up this wall?" "Well, I wanted to be here when you got in." She shook her head in bewilderment. "It would have been a great deal better if you'd been here when I went out. Is that why you're wearing those filthy old clothes?" "Yes. You don't think I went to dinner at St. Sed's like this?" "Well, I no longer know what you consider to be rational behaviour." She sighed and fished about in a small drawer. "Here," she said, "if it's going to save your life," and handed him a couple of keys on a ring. "I'm too tired to be angry anymore. An evening of being lobbied by Michael has taken it out of me." "Well, I'll never understand why you put up with him," said Richard, going to fetch the coffee. "I know you don't like him, but he's very sweet and can be charming in his sad kind of way. Usually it's very relaxing to be with someone who's so self-absorbed, because it doesn't make any demands on you. But he's obsessed with the idea that I can do something about his magazine. I can't, of course. Life doesn't work like that. I do feel sorry for him, though." "I don't. He's had it very, very easy all his life. He still has it very, very easy. He's just had his toy taken away from him, that's all. It's hardly unjust, is it?" "It's not a matter of whether it's just or not. I feel sorry for him because he's unhappy." "Well, of course he's unhappy. Al Ross has turned Fathom into a really sharp, intelligent magazine that everyone suddenly wants to read. It was just a bumbling shambles before." His only real function was to let Michael have lunch and toady about with whoever he liked on the pretext that maybe they might like to write a little something. He hardly ever got an actual issue out. The whole thing was a sham. He pampered himself with it. I really don't find that charming or engaging. I'm sorry, I'm going on about it, and I didn't mean to. Susan shrugged uneasily. I think you overreact, she said, though I think I will have to steer clear of him if he's going to keep on at me to do something I simply can't do. It's too exhausting. Anyway, listen, I'm glad you had a lousy evening. I want to talk about what we were going to do this weekend. Ah, said Richard. Well, oh, said Susan, I better just check the messages first. She walked past him to the telephone answering machine, played the first few seconds of Gordon's message, and then suddenly ejected the cassette. I can't be bothered, she said, giving it to him. Could you just give this straight to Susan at the office tomorrow? Save her a trip. If there's anything important on it, she can tell me. Richard blinked and said, yes, and pocketed the tape, tingling with the shock of the reprieve. Anyway, the weekend, said Susan, sitting down on the sofa. Richard wiped his hand over his brow. Susan, I'm afraid I've got to work, she said. Nicola's sick, and I'm going to have to dep for her at the Wigmore on Friday week. There's some Vivaldi and some Mozart I don't know too well, so that means a lot of extra practice this weekend, I'm afraid. Sorry. Well, in fact, said Richard, I have to work as well. He sat down by her. I know. Gordon keeps on at me to nag you. I wish he wouldn't. It's none of my business, and it puts me in an invidious position. I'm tired of being pressurized by people, Richard. At least you don't do that. She took a sip of her coffee. But I'm sure, she added, that there's some kind of grey area between being pressurized and being completely forgotten about that I'd quite like to explore. Oh, give me a hug. He hugged her, feeling that he was monstrously and unworthily lucky. An hour later, he let himself out and discovered that Pizza Express was closed. Meanwhile, Michael Wenton Weeks made his way back to his home in Chelsea. As he sat in the back of the taxi, he watched the streets with a blank stare and tapped his fingers lightly against the window in a slow, thoughtful rhythm. Rap-tap-tap-a-rap-tap-a-rap-a-tap. He was one of those dangerous people who are soft, squidgy, and cow-like, provided they have what they want. And because he had always had what he wanted, and had seemed easily pleased with it, it had never occurred to anybody that he was anything other than soft, squidgy, and cow-like. You would have to push through a lot of soft, squidgy bits in order to find a bit that didn't give when you pushed it. That was the bit that all of the soft, squidgy bits were there to protect. Michael Wenton Weeks was the younger son of Lord Magna, publisher, newspaper owner, and overindulgent father, under whose protective umbrella it had pleased Michael to run his own little magazine at a magnificent loss. Lord Magna had presided over the gradual but dignified and well-respected decline of the publishing empire originally founded by his father, the first Lord Magna. Michael continued to tap his knuckles lightly on the glass. A rap-tap, a rap-a-tap. He remembered the appalling, terrible day when his father had electrocuted himself changing a plug, and his mother, took over the business. Not only took it over, but started running it with completely unexpected verve and determination. She examined the company with a very sharp eye as to how it was being run, or walked, as she put it, and eventually even got around to looking at the accounts of Michael's magazine. Tap, tap, tap. Now, Michael knew just enough about the business side of things to know what the figures ought to be, and he had simply assured his father that that was indeed what they were. "Can't allow this job just to be a sinecure. You must see that, old fellow. You have to pay your way, or how would it look? How would it be?" his father used to say. And Michael would nod seriously and start thinking out the figures for next month, or whenever it was he would next manage to get an issue out. His mother, on the other hand, was not so indulgent. Not by a lorry load. Michael usually referred to his mother as an old battle-axe, but if she was fairly to compare to a battle-axe, it would only be to an exquisitely crafted, beautifully balanced battle-axe with an elegant minimum of fine engraving which stopped just short of its gleaming, razored edge. One swipe from such an instrument, and you wouldn't even know you'd been hit until you tried to look at your watch a little later and discovered that your arm wasn't on. She had been waiting patiently, or at least with the appearance of patience, in the wings all this time, being the devoted wife, the doting but strict mother. Now someone had taken her, to switch metaphors for a moment, out of her scabbard, and everyone was running for cover, including Michael. It was her firm belief that Michael, whom she quietly adored, had been spoiled, in the fullest and worst sense of the word, and she was determined at this late stage to stop it. It didn't take him more than a few minutes to see that he had simply been making up the figures every month, and that the magazine was hemorrhaging money as Michael toyed with it, all the time running up huge lunch bills, taxi accounts, and staff costs that he would playfully set against fictitious taxes. The whole thing had simply got lost somewhere in the gargantuan accounts of Magna House. She had then summoned Michael to see her. Tap, tap, tap-a-rapper, tap, tap, tap. "How do you want me to treat you?" she said. "As my son, or as the editor of one of my magazines? I'm happy to do either." "Your magazines? Well, I am your son, but I don't see..." "Right. Michael, I want you to look at these figures," she said, briskly, handing over a sheet of computer printout. "The ones on the left show the actual incomings and outgoings of Fathom. The ones on the right are your own figures. Does anything strike you about them?"
"Mother, I can explain. I..."
"Good," said Lady Magna sweetly. "I'm very glad of that." She took the piece of paper back. "Now, do you have any views on how the magazine should best be run in the future?"
"Yes, absolutely. Very strong ones. I..."
"Good," said Lady Magna with a bright smile. "Well, that's all perfectly satisfactory, then. Don't you want to hear..." "No, that's all right, dear. I'm just happy to know that you do have something to say on the matter to clear it all up. I'm sure the new owner of Fathom will be glad to listen to whatever it is."
"What?" said a stunned Michael. "You mean you're actually selling Fathom?"
"No, I mean I've already sold it. Didn't get much for it, I'm afraid. £1 plus a promise that you would be retained as the editor for the next 3 issues, and after that, it's at the new owner's discretion." Michael stared, pop-eyed. "Well, come now," said his mother reasonably. "We could hardly continue under the present arrangement, could we? You always agreed with your father that the job should not be a sinecure for you, and since I would have a great deal of difficulty in either believing or resisting your stories, I thought I would hand the problem on to someone with whom you could have a more objective relationship. Now, I have another appointment, Michael."
"Well, but who have you sold it to?" spluttered Michael.
"Gordon Way."
"Gordon Way? But for heaven's sake, Mother, he's..."
"He's very anxious to be seen to patronise the arts, and I think I do mean patronise. I'm sure you'll get on splendidly, dear. Now, if you don't mind..." Michael stood his ground.
"I've never heard of anything so outrageous. I..."
"Do you know, that's exactly what Mr. Way said when I showed him these figures and then demanded that you be kept on as editor for 3 issues." Michael huffed and puffed and went red and wagged his finger, but could think of nothing more to say, except, "What difference would it have made to all this if I'd said, 'Treat me as the editor of one of your magazines?'" "Why, dear," said Lady Magna with her sweetest smile, "I would have called you Mr. Wenton Weeks, of course, and I wouldn't now be telling you to straighten your tie," she added, with a tiny little gesture under her chin. Rap, tap, tap, rap, tap, tap. "Number 17, was it, Gov?"
What?"
said Michael, shaking his head. "It was 17, you said, was it?" said the cab driver. "'Cause we're here."
Oh, yes,
thank you," said Michael. He climbed out and fumbled in his pocket for some money.
"Tap, tap, tap, eh?"
"What?" said Michael, handing over the fare. "Tap, tap, tap," said the cab driver, "all the bloody way here. Got something on your mind, eh, mate?"
"Mind your own bloody business," snapped Michael savagely.
"Oh, if you say so, mate. Just thought you might be going mad or something," said the cabbie, and drove off. Michael let himself into his house and walked through the cold hall to the dining room, turned on the overhead light, and poured himself a brandy from the decanter. He took off his coat, threw it across the large mahogany dining table, and pulled a chair over to the window, where he sat nursing his drink and his grievances. Tap, 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 he went on the window. He had sullenly remained as editor for the stipulated 3 issues, and was then, with little ceremony, let go. A new editor was found, a certain A.K. Ross, who was young, hungry, and ambitious, and he quickly turned the magazine into a resounding success. Michael, in the meantime, had been lost and naked. There was nothing else for him. He tapped on the window again and looked, as he frequently did, at the small table lamp that stood on the sill. It was a rather ugly, ordinary little lamp, and the only thing about it that regularly transfixed his attention was that this was the lamp that had electrocuted his father, and this was where he had been sitting. The old boy was such a fool with anything technical. Michael could just see him peering with profound concentration through his half-moons and sucking his moustache as he tried to unravel the arcane complexities of a 13-amp plug. He had, it seemed, plugged it back in the wall without first screwing the cover back on, and then tried to change the fuse in situ. From this he received the shock which had stilled his already dicky heart. Such a simple, simple error, thought Michael, such as anyone could have made, anyone, but the consequences of it were catastrophic.
utterly catastrophic. His father's death, his own loss, the rise of the appalling Ross and his disastrously successful magazine, and tap, tap, tap. He looked at the window, at his own reflection, and at the dark shadows of the bushes on the other side of it. He looked again at the lamp. This was the very object, this the very place, and the error was such a simple one. Simple to make, simple to prevent. The only thing that separated him from that simple moment was the invisible barrier of the months that had passed in between. A sudden, odd calm descended on him, as if something inside him had suddenly been resolved. Tap, tap, tap. Fathom was his. It wasn't meant to be a success. It was his life. His life had been taken from him, and that demanded a response. Tap, tap, tap. Crack! He surprised himself by suddenly punching his hand through the window and cutting himself quite badly. Chapter 15. Some of the less pleasant aspects of being dead were beginning to creep up on Gordon Way as he stood in front of his cottage. It was, in fact, a rather large house by anybody else's standards, but he had always wanted to have a cottage in the country, and so when the time came for him finally to buy one, and he discovered that he had rather more money available than he had ever seriously believed he might own, he bought a large old rectory, and called it a cottage, in spite of its 7 bedrooms and its 4 acres of dank Cambridgeshire land. This did little to endear him to people who only had cottages. But then, if Gordon Way had allowed his actions to be governed by what endeared him to other people, he wouldn't have been Gordon Way. He wasn't, of course, Gordon Way any longer. He was the ghost of Gordon Way. In his pocket, he had the ghosts of Gordon Way's keys. It was this realization that had stopped him for a moment in his invisible tracks. The idea of walking through walls, frankly, revolted him. It was something he had been trying strenuously to avoid all night. He had instead been fighting to grip and grapple with every object he touched, in order to render it, and thereby himself, substantial. To enter his house, his own house, by any means other than that of opening the front door and striding in a proprietorial manner, filled him with a hurtling sense of loss. He wished, as he stared at it, that the house was not such an extreme example of Victorian Gothic, and that the moonlight didn't play so coldly on its narrow gabled windows and its forbidding turrets. He had joked stupidly when he bought it that it looked as if it ought to be haunted, not realizing that one day it would be, or by whom. A chill of the spirit gripped him as he made his way silently up the driveway, lined by the looming shapes of yew trees that were far older than the rectory itself. It was a disturbing thought that anybody else might be scared walking up such a driveway on such a night, for fear of meeting something such as him. Behind a screen of yew trees off to his left stood the gloomy bulk of the old church, decaying now, only used in rotation with others in neighbouring villages, and presided over by a vicar who was usually breathless from bicycling there, and dispirited by the few who were waiting for him when he arrived. Behind the steeple of the church hung the cold eye of the moon. A glimpse of movement seemed suddenly to catch his eye, as if a figure had moved in the bushes near the house, but it was, he told himself, only his imagination, overwrought by the strain of being dead. What was there here that he could possibly be afraid of? He continued onwards, around the angle of the wing of the rectory, towards the front door, set deep within its gloomy porch, wreathed in ivy. He was suddenly startled to realise there was light coming from inside the house, electric light and also the dim flicker of firelight. It was a moment or two before he realised that he was, of course, expected that night, though hardly in his present form. Mrs. Bennett, the elderly housekeeper, would have been in to make the bed, light the fire, and leave out a light supper for him. The television, too, would be on, especially so that he could turn it off impatiently upon entering. His footsteps failed to crunch on the gravel as he approached. Though he knew that he must fail at the door, he nevertheless could not but go there first, to try if he could open it. And only then, hidden within the shadows of the porch, would he close his eyes and let himself slip ashamedly through it. He stepped up to the door and stopped. It was open. Just half an inch, but it was open. His spirit fluttered in fearful surprise. How could it be open? Mrs. Bennett was always so conscientious about such things. He stood uncertainly for a moment, and then with difficulty exerted himself against the door. Under the little pressure he could bring to bear on it, it swung slowly and unwillingly open, its hinges groaning in protest. He stepped through and slipped along the stone-flagged hallway. A wide staircase led up into the darkness, but the doors that led off from the hallway all stood closed. The nearest door led into the drawing-room, in which the fire was burning, and from which he could hear the muted car chases of the late movie. He struggled futilely for a moment or two with its shiny brass doorknob, but was forced in the end to admit a humiliating defeat, and with a sudden rage flung himself straight at the door and through it. The room inside was a picture of pleasant domestic warmth. He staggered violently into it and was unable to stop himself floating on through a small occasional table set with thick sandwiches and a thermos flask of hot coffee, through a large overstuffed armchair, into the fire, through the thick hot brickwork, and into the cold dark dining room beyond. The connecting door back into the sitting room was also closed. Gordon fingered it numbly and then, submitting himself to the inevitable, braced himself and slid back through it calmly. Gently, noticing for the first time the rich internal grain of the wood. The coziness of the room was almost too much for Gordon, and he wandered distractedly around it, unable to settle, letting the warm liveliness of the firelight play through him. Him it couldn't warm. What, he wondered, were ghosts supposed to do all night? He sat uneasily and watched the television. Soon, however, the car chases drifted peacefully to a close, and there was nothing left but grey snow and white noise, which he was unable to turn off. He found he'd sunk too far into the chair and confused himself with bits of it as he pushed and pulled himself up. He tried to amuse himself by standing in the middle of a table, but it did little to alleviate a mood that was sliding inexorably from despondency downwards. Perhaps he would sleep. Perhaps. He felt no tiredness or drowsiness, but just a deadly craving for oblivion. He passed back through the closed door and into the dark hallway, from which the wide, heavy stairs led to the large, gloomy bedrooms above. Up these, emptily, he trod. It was for nothing, he knew. If you cannot open the door to a bedroom, you cannot sleep in its bed. He slid himself through the door and lifted himself onto the bed, which he knew to be cold, though he could not feel it. The moon seemed unable to leave him alone and shone full on him as he lay there, wide-eyed and empty, unable now to remember what sleep was or how to do it. The horror of hollowness lay on him, the horror of lying ceaselessly and forever awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had nowhere to go, nothing to do when he got there, and no one he could go and wake up who wouldn't be utterly horrified to see him. The worst moment had been when he had seen Richard on the road, Richard's face frozen white in the windscreen. He saw again his face and that of the pale figure next to him. That had been the thing which had shaken out of him the lingering shred of warmth at the back of his mind which said that this was just a temporary problem. It seemed terrible in the night hours, but would be all right in the morning when he could see people and sort things out. He fingered the memory of the moment in his mind and could not let it go. He had seen Richard. And Richard, he knew, had seen him. It was not going to be all right. Usually when he felt this bad at night, he popped downstairs to see what was in the fridge, so he went now. It would be more cheerful than this moonlit bedroom. He would hang around the kitchen, going bump in the night. He slid down and partially through the banisters, wafted through the kitchen door without a second thought, and then devoted all his concentration and energy for about 5 minutes to getting the light switch on. That gave him a real sense of achievement, and he determined to celebrate with a beer. After a moment or two of repeatedly juggling and dropping a can of Foster's, he gave it up. He had not the slightest conception of how he could manage to open a ring pull, and besides, the stuff was all shaken up by now, and what was he going to do with the stuff, even if he could get it open? He didn't have a body to keep it in. He hurled the can away from him, and it scuttled off under a cupboard. He began to notice something about himself, which was the way in which his ability to grasp things seemed to grow and fade in a slow rhythm, as did his visibility. There was an irregularity in the rhythm, though, or perhaps it was just that sometimes the effects of it would be much more pronounced than at others. That, too, seemed to vary according to a slower rhythm. Just at that moment it seemed to him that his strength was on the increase. In a sudden fever of activity, he tried to see how many things in the kitchen he could move or use or somehow get to work. He pulled open cupboards, yanked out drawers, scattering cutlery on the floor. He got a brief whir out of the food processor. He knocked over the electric coffee grinder without getting it to work. He turned on the gas on the cooker hob, but then couldn't light it. He savaged a loaf of bread with a carving knife. He tried stuffing lumps of bread into his mouth, but they simply fell through his mouth to the floor. A mouse appeared, but scurried from the room, its coat electric with fear. Eventually, he stopped and sat on the kitchen table, emotionally exhausted but physically numb. How, he wondered, would people react to his death? Who would be most sorry to know that he had gone? For a while, there would be shock, then sadness. Then they would adjust, and he would be a fading memory as people got on with their own lives without him, thinking that he had gone on to wherever people go. That was a thought that filled him with the most icy dread. He had not gone. He was still here. He sat facing one cupboard that he hadn't managed to open yet because its handle was too stiff, and that annoyed him. He grappled awkwardly with a tin of tomatoes and then went over again to the large cupboard and attacked the handle with the tin. The door flew open, and his own missing, blood-stained body fell horribly forward out of it. Gordon hadn't realized up to this point that it was possible for a ghost to faint. He realized it now and did it. He was woken a couple of hours later by the sound of his gas cooker exploding. Chapter 16. The following morning, Richard woke up twice. The first time, he assumed he'd made a mistake and turned over for a fitful few minutes more. The second time, he sat up with a jolt, as the events of the previous night insisted themselves upon him. He went downstairs and had a moody and unsettled breakfast, during which nothing went right. He burnt the toast, spilt the coffee, and realized that though he'd meant to buy some more marmalade yesterday, he hadn't. He surveyed his feeble attempt at feeding himself and thought that maybe he could at least allow himself the time to take Susan out for an amazing meal tonight to make up for last night, if he could persuade her to come. There was a restaurant that Gordon had been enthusing about at great length and recommending that they try. Gordon was pretty good on restaurants. He certainly seemed to spend enough time in them. He sat and tapped his teeth with a pencil for a couple of minutes, and then went up to his workroom and lugged a telephone directory out from under a pile of computer magazines. L'Esprit d'Escalier. He phoned the restaurant and tried to book a table, but when he said when he wanted it for, this seemed to cause a little amusement. Ah, no, monsieur, said the maitre d', I regret that it is impossible. At this moment it is necessary to make reservations at least 3 weeks in advance, pardon, monsieur. Richard marvelled at the idea that there were people who actually knew what they wanted to do 3 weeks in advance, thanked the maitre d' and rang off. Well, maybe a pizza again, instead. This thought connected back to the appointment he had failed to keep last night, and after a moment, curiosity overcame him, and he reached for the phone book again. Gentlemen, gentles, gentry. There was no gently at all, not a single one. He found the other directories, except for the Esther Z book, which his cleaning lady continually threw away for reasons he had never yet fathomed. There was certainly no Chelly or anything like it. There was no Gently with a J, no Gently with a DG, no Gently with a DJ, no Gently with a DZ, nor anything remotely similar. He wondered about TJ Entley, TS Entley, or TZ Entley, and tried director inquiries, but they were out. He sat and tapped his teeth with the pencil again, and watched his sofa slowly revolving on the screen of his computer. How very peculiar it had been that it had only been hours earlier that Reg had asked after Dirk with such urgency. If you really wanted to find someone, how would you set about it and what would you do? He tried phoning the police, but they were out too. Well, that was that. He had done all he could do for the moment short of hiring a private detective, and he had better ways of wasting his time and money. He would run into Dirk again, as he did every few years or so. He found it hard to believe that there were really such people, anyway, as private detectives. What sort of people were they? What did they look like? Where did they work? What sort of tie would you wear if you were a private detective? Presumably it would have to be exactly the sort of tie that people wouldn't expect private detectives to wear. Imagine having to sort out a problem like that when you just got up. Just out of curiosity as much as anything else, and because the only alternative was settling down to anthem coding, he found himself leafing through the yellow pages. Private detectives. See detective agencies. The words looked almost odd in such a solid and business-like context. He flipped back through the book. Dry cleaners, dog breeders, dental technicians, detective agencies. At that moment, the phone rang and he answered it, a little curtly. He didn't like being interrupted. Something wrong, Richard? Oh, hi, Kate. Sorry, no, I was... my mind was elsewhere. Kate Anselm was another star programmer at WayForward Technologies. She was working on a long-term artificial intelligence project, the sort of thing that sounded like an absurd pipe dream until you heard her talking about it. Gordon needed to hear her talking about it quite regularly, partly because he was nervous about the money it was costing, and partly because, well, there was little doubt that Gordon liked to hear Kate talking anyway. "I didn't want to disturb you," she said. "It's just I was trying to contact Gordon and can't. There's no reply from London, or the cottage, or his car, or his bleeper. It's just that for someone as obsessively in contact as Gordon, it's a bit odd. You heard he's had a phone put in his isolation tank, true?"
I haven't spoken to him since yesterday," said Richard.
He suddenly remembered the tape he had taken from Susan's answering machine, and hoped to God there wasn't anything more important in Gordon's message than ravings about rabbits. He said, "I know he was going to the cottage. I don't know where he is. Have you tried?" Richard couldn't even think of anywhere else to try. "Good God!" "Richard?
How extraordinary!
Richard, what's the matter?"
"Nothing, Kate. Just read the most astounding thing."
"Really? What are you reading?"
"Well, the telephone directory, in fact."
"Really? I must rush out and buy one. Have the film rights gone?"
"Look, sorry, Kate, can I..."